And we'll move to our last item of the day. Item seven, land use change on non-federal lands in Oregon and Washington. Still red. Yeah.
It's new technology.
Yeah.
So as Hillary gets the presentation pulled up, I will kick us off. I'm going to hand this over to Dan in just a second to kind of do the bulk of the presentation. So Chair Imeson, State Forester Daugherty, and members of the board, for the record, I'm Chad Davis. I work here at the department along with these two fine gentlemen here in the Partnership and Planning Program. And I'm happy to sit before you today and talk about non-federal land. Usually I'm up here talking about federal land. And today we, and particularly Dan, is going to talk a lot about non-federal land in the state of Oregon. This item comes to you as part of the emerging issues work plans that the board kind of adopted and set forward back earlier in the year. It's one of three emerging issues work plans. The other two are ecosystem services and climate change. And they will also begin to populate agendas in November and December with items from those other two work plans as well. We see all these work plans really as living documents, and we bring pieces to the board kind of in an information gathering stage, more discussion, and then we kind of take a stepwise approach about, okay, what is the next kind of piece of this topic that the board wants to explore? And so this is kind of the purpose of today is kicking off this conversation around land use in the state of Oregon. Of some previous work that it's good to see Gary Lettman in the audience here today. Gary's done this work and carried this torch for a very long time, and I'm sure we'll have some critiques for us in addition to your comments as well. So Peter often refers and talks about kind of a three-pronged approach in Oregon, and maybe these are my words and not his, to maintain working forests and promote ecosystem function of forest lands in the state of Oregon. And those three prongs being land use, statewide land use system, the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and then voluntary measures that individual landowners take to promote good activities and good outcomes on their own properties. We're going to talk about kind of the underpinning of that today a little bit, the statewide land use program, and look at that as it relates, again, to resource lands in the state of Oregon. So with me are our two primary staff on this topic. Dan Hubner is a GIS analyst who's worked on this data and on this report for quite a while, actually, before even starting at ODF. We recently lured him away from the Pacific Northwest Research Station, the FIA program, and really glad to have him step into his role here at ODF, and he brings a lot of capacity to our team in that regard. And then John Tokarczyk, immediately to my right, is really our policy lead, as I think about it as it relates to land use. So when the 30,000 bills hit session next year dealing with land use, they will all go to John's desk. And John is the one that kind of performs the initial analysis about whether they are relevant to forestry or not, and works really closely with colleagues over at DLCD. So with that, I really want to turn this over to Dan to kind of walk us through a recent update.
All right. Hello, Chair Imeson, State Forester Daugherty, members of the board. My name is Dan Hubner. I'm an analyst in the Partnership and Planning Program. And I'm going to be walking us through kind of an overview of this study and the methodology it uses, go through some key results related to non-federal resource land and forest land in particular in Oregon. And then later on, I'll turn it back over to Chad for some discussion of further exploratory policy relevant analysis we've been doing. So to give some background on the study in general, it's an ongoing project that's been going on since before my time here. As Chad mentioned, Gary Lettman carried it forward for a long time here. And basically, this is a study that's done in collaboration with the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station, as well as several state agencies, agriculture, ODFW, DLCD and the Institute for Natural Resources at OSU. And it's basically studying long-term land use change on non-federal land in Oregon and Washington since the 1970s. And basically it uses a sample-based approach to quantify land use types and structure density on non-federal land throughout the two states. And the sample is collected at various years since the 70s in Oregon. It's 1974, 84, 94, 2000, 05, 2009, and the most recent update was 2014. So although this report is the 2018 update published in 2018, the most recent data is 2014 for Oregon, 2013 for Washington. So, and the kind of the key questions that we're trying to get at with this data is primarily how successful the state's land use planning program has been at preserving resource lands from development, so forest lands, farmlands, rangelands, and looking at how trends in land use change differed before and after implementation of statewide land use planning, and looking as well at how land use trends varied with regard to the pretty significant population increases both states have seen over that time. Oregon's population increased by 74% over this study period, about 1.7 million people, and even greater increase in Washington. And then more recently, with the most recent time period in this study, we've also been trying to look at how trends in land conversion have been impacted by the 2007 recession, and going forward, whether there might be upticks in conversion as associated with the recovery after that. So I'll run through the basic methodology of the study real quickly here. And it's, as I said, it's a sample-based study. And for each time period since the 70s, analysts assess an aerial image at each sample point. And there's over 37,000 sample points in Oregon. And for each sample point, we assign a land use class to that point, and then we count the structures in the surrounding 80 acres. So across the bottom there, what you see is just an example of that for the most recent periods in Oregon, 2005, 2009, 2014. The yellow circle is an 80-acre buffer around the sample point. The sample point gets attributed with the land use that's at the center of that circle. So in this example, it's forested land use at all times. But then counting the structures in the surrounding 80 acres, this is an area where at the north there, you can see there's been suburban development filling in. So each individual residence in that area gets counted over time. And then just for some quick information, these are the 8 land use classes that are utilized in this project, and we'll look at some examples of those. But the key thing is that what's considered the resource land uses are wildland forest, wildland range, intensive agriculture, and mixtures thereof. And then what's considered the developed uses are low-density residential commercial zones and urban zones. And then the 8th land use class is the other, which represents areas like bare mountaintop rock and beaches, lakes, things like that. And there are some nuances to these definitions as well, like a wildland forest zone for these purposes has to be at least a square mile in size. So it's not just anywhere that a sample point happens to fall on a tree. There's a size threshold as well for these zones. And these are just some examples of those classes. So across the bottom of this image, you can see there's a heavily urbanized zone. Then up on the top, there's a mixed forest agriculture zone with some agricultural fields and forested area and some lower density residential up at the top. And a couple more examples here. I think the key thing with this one on the right is you can see the difference between a wildland forest zone and then a low density residential zone that contains a lot of trees. But for the purposes of this study, that's all a low density residential zone that's impacted by the housing that's interspersed throughout there.
What's the threshold for low density?
Low density residential can be any size, but it has to have at least 9 developments on it. It has to have at least 9 residential developments on it. Just total. For low density residential, there's no size threshold like the resource zones have. So it's just 9 developments not in another use in that are within a quarter mile of each other. So now we'll move on into the results, kind of starting at the highest level, looking at land use statewide, and then kind of zeroing in on some trends regarding resource lands and forest lands in particular. So these maps here show the land use according to this study at the most recent time. That's 2014 in Oregon and 2013 in Washington. So no big surprises there. The red areas are the urban zones. So you see the Portland metro area, Puget Sound, Bend area. Nothing too surprising on there. And then more to the point, these maps show the land use change that has occurred since the 1970s. So what you're looking at on this one is the yellow areas are areas that were already developed in 1974 in Oregon. And the red specks throughout there are the areas that were in resource uses in the 1970s, but have been developed since then. So basically, this shows you where land use planning has directed development since the 1970s. So this is just a very broad scale look at the current breakdown of land in Oregon, according to these definitions, and the conversions that have occurred since the 70s. So you see over half of the land in Oregon is federal land. Then the big green chunk is non-federal land that is in resource uses. And down at the bottom there, the yellow is other non-federal land. So that's largely non-federal land that was already developed in the 1970s. And then the orange portion are those areas that were in resource uses in the 70s, but have been developed since then. So in Oregon, that comes to about 700,000 acres of land that have been developed. That's about 2.6% of Oregon's non-federal resource land that has been converted to other uses since the 70s. And by comparison, in Washington, that figure is 4.5% of their non-federal resource land converted since the 70s. And these line graphs here look at the trend across that time from the 1970s to present for the two states, Oregon in blue, Washington in red. And you're looking at the percent, the proportion of non-resource land that has come out of those uses since the 1970s. So in 1974, that's the 100% benchmark for Oregon. And how has that shifted since then? And the smaller graphs on the right side partition it out by the west and east side, the east sides of the state. So as you would expect, there's steeper trends of conversion on the west side than on the east side. And then also on these charts, there are the vertical dashed lines indicating when comprehensive land use planning took full effect in the two states. And you see there that there's a, for Oregon, there's a leveling off after the mid-80s when comprehensive planning took full effect. The rates of conversion of resource land to developed uses started leveling off a bit there and diverged from Washington. And then this graph is the same thing, but looking at wildland forest in particular, not all resource lands, just the wildland forest. So it's the same kind of trend that you see as in all resource lands, that rates of conversion kind of leveled off a bit after implementation of planning. And what that comes to is that basically since the 1970s, Oregon has retained about 98% of the land that was in wildland forest use in the 70s is still in that use in 2014. Washington is about 95%.
Can I ask a question on this graph? So it looks like the point of deflection for Oregon corresponds to full implementation of our state land use planning, but there is no point of deflection at the red dot.
Yeah, and that's what we saw, that there is a bit of a point of inflection there for Washington, but nowhere near as stark, and there's a much starker point of inflection associated with the 2007 recession.
But then in Washington, there is further down the line a pretty stark point of deflection. Any guesses as to what?
Yeah, we believe that that's associated with the 2007 recession, the economic slowdown rather than the policy implementation. And this breaks down that change in wildland forest a little more fine-grained by the ownership types. So Oregon overall, as I said, lost about 2% of its wildland forest since the 1970s converted to other uses, but that's also not steady across all ownership types. So as you might expect, there was pretty minimal conversion on public lands and on industrial forest lands, and the majority of conversion of forest to other uses occurred on non-industrial private lands. And then this is trying to get at not just conversion, but the issue of fragmentation and development on lands that are remaining in wildland forest use. So looking at not how much forest land was converted to other uses, but how much forest land that had less than 10 residents per square mile in the 70s still has less than 10 residents per square mile in 2014. And again, you see that same kind of trend as in the previous graphs. And in this case, what you're looking at is for Oregon, 93% of the wildland forest that had less than 10 residents per square mile in the 70s still has less than 10 residents per square mile in 2014. So that's that contrasts to then for conversion, 98% of forest land wasn't converted, 93% still has less than 10 residents per square mile. So you're looking at a proportionally much larger area of wildland forest that has had residential development dispersed into it than has been fully converted to urban or residential uses.
So what's the threshold for housing density that takes it out of wildland forest?
For the definition of the wildland forest zone, you have to have less than 5 residences per square mile on average, though not so that's an average for a full forest zone. So if there's more than 10 residents per square mile in a contained area, that would convert it to a low density residential or an urban zone. But if it's more dispersed, then may not be converted, but on average for that wildland forest zone could have more than 10 residents per square mile.
And on this graph, there's sort of 2 deflection points for Oregon, one where we sharply increased and then another where we leveled out back to the original incursions. And it looks like the second where we get back to the same slope was probably the recession. But what caused the around 2000 dramatic increase in the number of in the encroachment?
Yeah,
any speculation?
I don't have a clear answer for that. I'm speculation-wise, I mean, I think that the rate of population increase in the state may have increased in that time. That's just off the top of my head.
Not maybe way off the target, but I think that's the period when we had the dot-com boom, at least in eastern Oregon, and we saw a lot of investment from out of eastern Oregon coming into eastern Oregon with all the money that was made during that stock market.
Wealthy people go into their dream home.
Chair Imeson, State Forester Dougherty, members of the committee, John Dekarzik. One of the other aspects in this graph that's kind of an interesting component is that around 10 residents per square mile is where the capacity to manage starts to be challenged, which is another aspect of this graph. And so where you see that fragmentation start to occur, it starts to challenge the precepts of where active forest management occurs. So it gives you an indication of that.
All right, so that was a quick run through of kind of some of the key results from the most recent study. And now we'll move into kind of trying to get more precisely at that question of the trends before and after land use planning implementation and of the impact of the 2007 recession. So what you see on this slide here with the bar graphs is the total amount of land conversion from resource uses into other uses before full implementation of planning and after. So in Oregon at the bottom there, the blue bar represents the 10 years prior to full implementation, and the red bar represents the 30 years after that. So you can see that of the about 700,000 acres of resource land that was converted to developed uses over this time, almost half of it occurred in those first 10 years pre-planning, and the remainder was spread out over the following 30 years. In Washington, the time periods are a little different, but it's not as stark of a difference there. The blue is 18 years prior to implementation. The red is 19 years after. So there is a decline, but not as stark as you see in Oregon. And this graph gets at that same issue, but looking at it in terms of a net average annual conversion rate. So the key thing there for Oregon, the 10 years prior to and the 10 years immediately after full implementation, there's a decrease in the conversion rate of resource lands of about half. And in Washington, it's a decrease of only about 6%. And then this is the same thing, the net average annual conversion rates, but looking instead of policy implementation at the periods before and after the 2007 recession. So you can see there, both states had a pretty strong response to that. Washington started at a much higher annual conversion rate than Oregon and really leveled off after that point. And from there, I'm going to turn it back over to Chad to discuss some of the further exploratory analysis we've been applying this land use data to regarding water quality, fish habitat.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So I think the take home here is that if you were sitting around the board looking at this presentation in 2000 and what year did you give it, Gary? 2011, maybe last. You would have, if we round up or down, you would have heard the same numbers. 97% of resource land still exists. 98% of forest land still exists. So there's still value in maintaining kind of that look. Our partners over at DLCD and ODA continue to want this kind of data. We work closely with the PNW Research Station here, so it is kind of a cost-shared project with them, and kind of provides a level of support and connection to other resource agencies that also look at land use as kind of pivotal in terms of achieving their mission. However, you know, I did kind of flippantly say 30,000 bills. There's probably not quite that many on land use. Land use is always a hot topic during legislative session. And I would say in my experience over the last two full sessions, it's become even more apparent that there may be movement at times on particular pieces of it. And so I think this base kind of analysis work will become more and more important. And I think we'll be looked to and drawn upon. And what we really kind of wanted to then have a conversation with you all about is kind of understanding what resource implications or interconnections there might be. So we've always done this kind of base level work, which has been foundational. And I think now with GIS capability, with data sets more shareable across agencies, the opportunity to link things and to overlay them and to look for maybe watch outs or those kinds of things is just more capable than it's probably ever been for somebody that's more capable than me to do it. So we added a few things in, and I should say that's the royal we. The team added a few things in to kind of start to look at what the intersection was. And really this has meant, next few slides are just meant as a teaser as we start to explore the topic and things that you might want to have us explore and then bring back. And I think the point of hopefully if we leave some time here today is to kind of gather some ideas from you all. And then, as I said, work plan being kind of a working document, go back, think about that, think about what data sets exist, what spatial scales are relevant to those kinds of questions, and then bring back some proposed kind of things that we could come back to the board with. One thing, obviously, that you all have dealt with a lot has been water quality. Something that again, State Forester Daugherty always talks about is the relative quality of water on Oregon's forest land. So this is actually, again, very exploratory kind of stuff, overlaying DEQ's water quality data with land use data and looking at overlaps and correlations. And so you can see, and this is just a result of kind of overlaying some DEQ data with this kind of underlying land use data. Not really planning to talk too much in detail about this, but other than just to say, this is the kind of stuff that I think is possible when we start slicing and dicing data. Another thing that we've looked at, working and talking to folks in the private forest division, this is not a full-blown analysis by any stretch of the imagination, but again, overlaying Samanid habitat with where we have seen those land use changes occur in both Oregon and Washington. And so the information that Dan shared and his predecessors before him, it takes a statewide look, right, at what land use trends are doing. The question could be around particular resource issues, particular economic issues. Are there sub-regional trends or sub-state trends that we want to zoom in on a little bit more? And I'm not suggesting that we would want to do that with this particular layer, but just as a way to kind of to look a little closer at where those two things or where two high priorities kind of overlap so that we can try to get ahead of unavoided consequences when we are considering land use changes and or resource changes or rule changes as they relate. So with that, I kind of just wanted to kind of really now put this presentation in the board's lap to think with us about some interesting things that you think, there might be an interesting intersection on some other policy agenda that might be on your work plans or on your minds going forward.
So I do have several ideas. One, the actual report is at a fairly high level, and I know there's a lot more data. So more analysis of the conversion of forested data to the different categories. I believe you have those tables, but just being able to make those available publicly could be great. So, wildland forest to residential, what are the transfer categories? Where is land use going? And for our policy questions, we're more interested in the state of forest lands and and again, I don't know the limits of the data as well as you do. So just that general idea. One of the things I've always toyed with or made the argument for is the Forest Practice Act is always compared as on an input basis, that our rules aren't as restrictive as state. Oh, I think the most recent one is even less restrictive than Idaho, which I apologize to Idaho for that, but what's our ability to use the land use data to look at forest land in an outcome based, and you're getting at that with the water quality. If you had fish habitat quality, it would be interesting if we could do comparisons. The logic one is Washington, since you have the data set in both places. Can we see differences in outcomes based on the retention of working forests versus conversion to non-wildland forest?
I agree. I think that would be, I also hear comparisons with our neighboring states. Sorry, we're struggling.
It's late in the day.
He's just upset because his battery went out and I was given the new one. So I've offered to share, but I think that kind of outcomes-based piece of it would be really helpful because I'd get the same kinds of comments, I guess, that others do about comparison of our Forest Practices Act or, the way we manage riparian areas and that sort of thing with other states. It would be helpful to understand more about that and what the impacts are and what the ultimate result is, I guess.
I really appreciate you guys doing this. This is, I think Chad's heard me say this before, but I have this pet peeve about this, and I don't ever want us to think that because, Gary would have showed us the same numbers in 2011 and we would have seen this slow rate of transfer that therefore our system works and we don't really need to worry about it, because I just don't believe that's true. And I think there are a lot of factors that affect that. Obviously, one is this projected population increase and a whole range of other factors related to drought and water availability and where things grow and where people want to recreate. And then, you know, what is the ongoing value of these lands as working lands, and how does that change over time, and how does that change or affect people's decisions about whether to retain those lands or sell them to some other use? And then I'm also aware there's been quite a lot of studies from Western Montana about new landowners that have more sort of sophistication in approaching in basically bending local land use laws to meet their own needs and bringing more lawyers than a local county planning department can really defend against. And you know, having lived in Eastern Oregon and worked with city council in city planning groups and county planning commissions, I mean, I could easily see that happening. And so also beyond what we have for state rules, you know, thinking about when and how should ODF work with the county commissioners and the planning commissions as issues come up, to at least express the values of these lands in their current use. And then the other piece that comes up certainly in Eastern Oregon beyond the fish and water quality, which I think are both really important, is wildlife connectivity and these whole landscape permeability analyses of how conducive is that landscape to the movement of wildlife through that. And I think, again, and I don't know, I'm sure it differs for different wildlife species, but you know, this notion that as you begin to even get some dispersed residential development, this 10 per square mile or whatever, you know, it's going to begin to have an effect on that permeability index. And I think those are things that we all need to keep in mind, and how do our working landscapes fit into people's vision of a large conservation landscape? What role are they playing, and how do we sustain them in that use?
Thank you.
We did. We're done, huh? That's the self-regulating. You've only got so many minutes of mic. I was interested to see your land use water quality comparison that showed forest against all others. I'd like to see maybe the all others broken out as well, because obviously that's going to I assume the urban is going to really skew some of the other resource lands. And so it'd be, you know, we're typically not looking at too many situations where the conversions we're talking about are from forest to urban. And so for a lot of the discussions we have, it'd be more useful, I think, to see that kind of information broken out in, so that we can look at where the conversion that is most likely to occur, how it compares, because I'm assuming that, you know, the low density residential probably also doesn't have as clean a water as the forest.
Just
lost
this one.
Just loud.
A more legitimate comparison than combining all together.
Okay.
Also, I guess just because of the squirrely way my mind works, even though it's a very small percentage of the forest that is poor and fair.
If they're on the water quality, if there's any information that might characterize where we're having poor and fair water quality on forest land, and why, that would be useful to me. And I really liked everything else that Neil said. And then I'll shut up before I kill the third one.
Is this the information that we use when we're expanding taxing districts for the fire?
No, the land classification process is a separate process. It's done by the local county in terms of classifying it as forest land for fire protection. So rural residential areas that had been wildland forests that are rural residential forest are usually assessed as forest land for fire protection. It has to do with more of their characterization as a fire hazard or risk of wildfire. So rural residential adjacent to wildland forest would normally be assessed as forest.
So with the mention of fire, that actually triggered another one in my mind. Earlier fire update indicated that we had a significant increase this year in human fire starts. So looking at your classifications against human fire starts would probably also be an interesting...
They presented a slide of that. They used the wildland urban interface, which is a slightly different definition.
Yeah.
And they showed human caused starts, and they are concentrated in the wildland urban interface, as you might expect. The majority of them follow that development. So I think that whole issue kind of goes along with the question. It was not only the threshold for propensity to do active management, but also a threshold for increased fire cost, at least the original study back. That was quite a while ago that was.
Using this data to sort of re-examine that, I think it'd be a cool thing.
So thanks. I'll just summarize by saying it's good to have team members up here. And Dan, thanks for your work on this pre and post. And Gary, before that. So I'll turn it back over to the chair.
Turn it back over to me. Any other comments from board members on any item or from Peter? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.